an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I'm going to talk about the Diamond Sutra. So, I attended online a class at Green Gulch Farms, in which it was a 4-week class in which we talked about the Diamond Sutra. And I'll tell you what the Diamond Sutra is in a minute. First of all, I'll tell you a little bit about the class. The class was once a week in the evening. There were breakout groups you could meet with. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to take advantage of that because of my work schedule. And there were lectures given. And also on the last Saturday, there was a one-day sesshin again online. I would have loved to go, but unfortunately Green Gulch is still closed due to COVID to people who aren't residents or otherwise have special dispensation. Anyway, it was a great class. The Diamond Sutra has been called the oldest printed book in the world. Fu Schroeder, who facilitated the class, called it that. My quick Google search wasn't able to fully verify that, but that's okay. There are a lot of old books. It may be depends on how you define a book. But anyway, it's old. It was found in a cave. I should have written that down.
Western China? Northwestern?
Yeah. That sounds totally right. And and it was found in about 888 current era. It was actually, it was long after the Buddha lived, but it purports to be the teachings of Buddha, and Buddha is a character in it. So whether he said these things and they were later remembered and written down, or whether he didn't, but people said, this is pretty much the spirit of his teaching and then had him say it, I don't know. But it's basically a series of dialogues between one of his chief disciples, Subhuti, and Buddha, in which Subhuti is basically asking, how do we practice with what you're telling us? And the Buddha tells him basically over and over, don't be attached, don't be attached, don't be attached. And that non-attachment includes pretty much everything that was known of the Dharma at the time, I think, or that was considered concepts, or it's very exhaustive. What is the Buddha? Don't be attached to that. What is the Dharma? Don't be attached to that. What are the six perfections? Don't be attached to that. And it's also, if this sounds kind of familiar, it's because it's part of the Prajnaparamita literature. So the Heart Sutra, no eyes, no ears, no nose, this is the same kind of thing. Don't be attached. Know this, know that. Not no with your head, no, N-O. So I think that a little bit of, I think everybody kind of knows these terms about form and emptiness, but because this is being recorded and people who check us out may not know as much, or it may be good to have a refresher. The Diamond Sutra is all about form and emptiness. Oh, one more thing I forgot to mention is the name. The name it's also called the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and I've heard it described two ways. One way is that the Dharma in the sutra is the diamond that cuts through our mind, which is a very stubborn thing. But like jewelers contemporary to the time it was taught, used to use a diamond to cut every other jewel. And so it's like that. I also thought I heard Fu say that our minds are the diamond, and there's something even tougher than the diamond that cuts through them, and that's the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So either way, something very tough and that can cut through all of our BS, and get right to our direct experience. So that's a little bit of what is the Diamond Sutra. A little bit about form and emptiness. Form is basically the things that we are familiar with. Me, you, the journal I'm holding, and it also relates to all of our concepts. What do I think about Zach here? Only good things, Zach, of course. But it's all the things I think about, all the things in this room and this journal that I've written many things and etc. It's our ideas. That's the form world, the conventional world. Emptiness is that everything is so completely connected that it can't be separated in any way. That everything is the universe, and in fact, even say it's connected is saying too much because you're using words to describe it. Unfortunately, I'm not sure I have time to get much deeper in emptiness because I feel that's very inadequate, but I'm going to say it has to do for the moment. I'll go into a little bit deeper as I discuss it, but this is just sort of to orient us a little bit. There's also an important idea of the two truths that's part of the Diamond Sutra, and the two truths are that there's the form world and there's the empty world, and that we have to live in both. We can't ignore the fact that we're different for practical, obvious practical reasons in the form world. But if we get too caught up in it, we may be quarrel because when I told Zach I only thought good things of him, he maybe thought, well, I don't think that's true. And then he confronts me later and we get into a fight. So that's getting too caught up into the form world. So we don't want either one. But we need to know that they're both truth. So, and then the final thing is prajna, or wisdom, is seeing the empty nature of all things. And that goes hand in hand with karuna, or compassion, which is having compassion for all beings that are get stuck in the form world, and using skillful means to help ourselves and others to not be trapped in the form world or not be attached to the form world or an emptiness either for that matter. But most of us don't have so much of a problem being stuck in emptiness, although that does happen. Most of us are caught in the form world. So there are a lot of commentaries, so this is going to be a little bit impressionistic as we get into it. But so that's as close to scholarly as I go that I've just given you. I'm going to now read you a verse from the Diamond Sutra that kind of illustrates what I've been talking about here, that actually is what I've been talking about. The way it starts is, it starts with, thus have I heard, which means Ananda, Buddha's cousin, has been listening and memorized it and is telling us that. That's at least the conceit. But what he heard, he starts with, that means it's authentic, basically. Anyway, he begins with, early in the morning, when the mealtime came, Buddha put on his robe and, holding his bowl, entered the great city of Srivasti, where he begged for food. Having finished begging from door to door, he came back to his own seat in the garden and took his meal. When this was done, he put away his robe and bowl, washed his feet, spread his seat, and sat down, mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. So after all that buildup, Buddha's just going about his ordinary day. It's nothing special. That's what we do. We get up, we have our breakfast, maybe take a shower if that's part of our routine, and we find a way to procure our food. In Buddha's case, it was begging. That isn't something special either in this context. So that's our form world. And that's, again, why we have the two truths, because after we're about to talk about don't hold on to anything, but then if somebody says, well, if there's no self, how did Buddha do these things? Well, because that's true too. Don't hold on to, there is no thing. So we're already getting into it a little bit. So it then begins with Shabuti asking him a question for practice tips, as I put it, but he basically says, What should someone who arouses their thought for supreme awakening, and how should they abide in it, and should they keep their thoughts under control? And so Buddha says, okay, let's talk about that. And first he talks about the great vow. And the great vow is the vow to save all beings. Or it's alternately said, awaken with all beings, but it's the idea that we want to be free from our attachments to form or emptiness, and we want to help everybody else to do so. And actually, if we have to choose, we let others go first. We let others be liberated first. That's the Bodhisattva vow. So then Buddha talks about this vow, which was well known, or this way of thinking. I'm not sure they had it in the formulation of the four. We have four vows where we say, I vow to save all beings, etc. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. But whether or not it was, he's talking about this very dedication to saving all beings. One of the things the Buddha says in his first response is, all the bodhisattva, mahasattvas, that's beings who have, who try to free other people, great beings who free other beings. All the bodhisattva mahasattvas who undertake the practice of meditation should cherish one thought only. When I attain perfect wisdom, I will liberate all sentient beings in every realm of the universe, whether they be egg-born, womb-born, moisture-born, or miraculously born, those with form, those without form, those with perception, those without perception, those with neither perception nor non-perception. So long as any form of being is conceived, I must allow it to pass into the eternal peace of nirvana, into that realm of nirvana that leaves nothing behind, and to attain final awakening. And yet, although immeasurable, innumerable, and unlimited beings have been liberated, truly no being has been liberated. Why? Because no bodhisattva, who is a true bodhisattva, entertains such concepts as a self, a person, a being, or a living soul. Thus, there are no sentient beings to be liberated, and no self to attain perfect wisdom. So, what do you think about that? I think I'll go on a little bit. This was a little bit hard for me, of course, and the next verse is also a little bit hard. He says,
it only gets worse.
It only gets worse, yeah. Let me read on and explain. Nope, that's not how it works at this time in Sutra. He says, furthermore, Subhuti, in the practice of generosity, a bodhisattva should be unsupported. He or she should practice generosity without regard to sight, sound, touch, flavor, smell, or any thought that arises in it. Okay, so I'm to be completely generous, but I'm not looking at anything, I'm not hearing anything, I'm not smelling anything. What does that mean? Well, that's me taking without regard. Practice generosity without regard to sight, taking that kind of literally. Like, I don't think it means ignore everything I see and feel and smell, but I think, again, this is about not being attached. So the example that comes to mind here is, like, I've decided to be generous, but the first opportunity I have is this homeless person on the street who's kind of, it's kind of smelly, and I think, oh, not that one. I don't think that's what it means. Don't just help the beautiful people, or people you perceive as beautiful. Or what if I say, okay, I'm going to pick the most degraded person in my mind that I can find to help. Don't do that either. You're not, so we're advised not to be pushed around by our judgments and our thoughts and our senses, to just be generous. Just be open to every opportunity. And to not think, I'm a generous person. Again, it's about not just not being pulled around by our senses, but not being pulled around by our thoughts. That I'm a generous person, or even, I'm going to be generous today. There's an I in that, isn't there? So, Here's a little bit of a formulation that Fu was telling us about that I'm pretty sure she didn't make up, but this is another way to think of the whole formulation of every verse in the Diamond Sutra. It's the idea that first there's a proposition, call it A. Then there's another proposition, call it not A. A is actually not A. Then there's a final proposition, therefore, we call it A. Right? So what's that all about? I think that now is time to take a sip of water from my cup and talk about the cup. Okay, here's A. This is the cup. Wait. So that seems to imply that it's completely separate from the universe. This is maybe even the cup. No, it's one of many. Also, it didn't just spontaneously appear by itself. It was made somehow. It was glazed somehow. It was painted on. So there was a painter to paint this picture. There was somebody who made the glazing. I don't know if this came from a factory. It kind of looks like it was. So there, the factory was built. There were employees there. The factory was on land. The land was on the earth. And I go back far enough, and it turns out the universe made this cup. And it turns out that this cup doesn't exist without the universe. And it's not floating in midair. A hand is holding it. And this hand that's holding it is part of a person, and the person is dependent on the floor, and the person was born. Okay, you kind of see the point? The cup is not just empty. Actually, it's not empty in the conventional sense. It has water in it, but it's empty in that it doesn't exist independently. So the form is, here's a cup. But it's the emptiness is that the cup doesn't really exist by itself, so it's not A. And then, but we've got to call it something. I mean, if I say, do I have to just point at everything? What if the cup's not in the room? So I have to call it something. And I have an illustration with me that Chie, who's on this call, and who is a Zen student and a painter, and my wife, drew and painted. It says, I'm going to show you it in a minute. It says, well, I'll show you it first. I think I'll have my Jisha, what I'll do is I'll show you it, you probably can't see it. I'm going to have the Jisha show you it, and then I'm going to pass it around. So it says, this is a cup, this is also a non-cup, this is a whole universe. So what came up for me in this, one of the many things that came up was that, hold on, Zach, could you see if somebody had typed a message, please? Something just came up.
Chat.
Yeah, I think it was a chat.
Chie says, thank you, I'm glad my painting was shared.
So one of the many things that came up about this is, I understand when it comes to cups, you have to call it something. And I kind of understand when it comes to Buddha and the Dharma, it's really, really rarefied and hard to understand, but you have to talk about it in some way. But what about things that, like, people want you to accept as conventional truth that you may not want to accept? Does that mean you accept every word as it is, and you just don't push at it because, after all, it's not really the truth? You just practice with compassion? Like, something that came to mind is, there are many contemporary examples, but just to kind of keep this from becoming going on a sidetrack, when I was younger, when I was growing up, I'm pretty sure I was still in the phase where we said things like policeman and stewardess, and it was like very sort of binary. And then after it's also possible that that was my family, and I learned later. But the trend came to you know, say police officer and flight attendant. So, you know, if you just accept conventional truth, it sounds like you're excluding some people. You know, you can accept all kinds of conventional truths by accepting words, by not delving into them. Is that a conventional truth? Well, yes and no, but as if anticipating where my mind was going, when Fu was giving her lecture, she said that this applies to kind speech, skillful speech, wise speech. The idea is not to be attached to words. So if the word is not skillful, if it doesn't lead to liberation, it doesn't mean we have to accept that word and just say, well, Buddha said, just accept words because we have to use words, we have to use language. In fact, the spirit underlying this idea of conventional and emptiness, of form and emptiness, is not to get attached to things. So if a word is not leading to liberation, and in the case of saying that implying that certain jobs aren't open to any gender, then we can question it and maybe even discard it. We can always question words. So it definitely doesn't mean that we're stuck with exactly the language we have. It's quite the opposite. And then I know that the other question is, how do we practice with all of this negation? How do we practice with no, no, no? Well, let's try a poem. Shibuti asks a similar question. What he asks later is, he basically asks, how should I teach this to other people? I mean, Buddha, this is a lot, and I mean, I think I get it, but how do I teach it? And so Buddha summed it up for him in a verse. He said, so should you view all of the fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in the stream, a flash of lightning in the summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. So you should view all of the fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in the summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. I don't know about you, but I found one to be opening and soothing. And I also was struck that the only emotional words in it are the last two, a phantom and a dream. A phantom can mean something that's frightening, that's dreadful, but it also means that it's something that isn't really there usually, or that we mistake. And a dream, it can be a lovely dream or it can be a nightmare. But the bottom line is that it's neither a phantom nor a dream is something that lasts, nor is it our real life, nor is it our true experience. So what keeps us in this dream? There's another idea called the desire realm. So I've talked about form and emptiness. There's also an idea about the desire realm. And that's explained by Musong in this book of commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. It's just called the Diamond Sutra, and it's Musong, M-U-S-O-E-N-G. So the example that's often used to talk about this idea of the form, desire, and emptiness realm is that is a mirage of water in the desert. The water is perceived by the traveler as a solid real object. This is the imaginary aspect. The imagining of water is dependent on the thirst of the traveler. When the traveler reaches the spot where the water was imagined, no water is to be found. This lack of water in the imagined object is the ultimate, or the absolute, as I've been calling it. What becomes clear through this formulation is that our underlying thirst for having or becoming distorts our perception of reality in ways that allow us to imagine things as solid objects, where there is no solidity, but only a momentary construction that is the result of interdependent causes and conditions. When you reach out to touch what seems solid, it turns out to be a mirage, an illusion. That includes our cherished selves. So, was there an answer to Shibuti's question about practice pointers? The question again was, for someone who arouses the thought for the supreme awakening, how should they abide in it, and how should they keep their thoughts under control? Well, in chapter 10 of the Diamond Sutra, in one translation, there's an answer. Abiding nowhere, awakened mind arises. That's the answer to how should they abide in it and keep their thoughts under control. Abiding nowhere, awakened mind arises. It's not attached to anything, of course. But don't be attached to, don't attach to anything, right? These very words, actually, the story says, woke up the fifth ancestor after Bodhidharma. He was an illiterate woodcutter who was just doing his job in the market, and a traveling pilgrim, a monk, was reciting aloud the Diamond Sutra and came to those lines. And instantly, Huai Neng, our fifth ancestor, woke up. And he started to seek, what is the source of those words? He asked the traveling monk, and he, I'm not going to go into the story, but he sought to learn more, and he eventually was ordained as a priest and became one of the great teachers. Another translation from the Musong book is, a bodhisattva should develop a mind that functions freely, without depending on anything or any place. Personally, I like this one. Abiding nowhere, awakened mind arises. I think we have time for very few questions, but it's 11:10. But I'd love to hear a question if you can stay. Kelly.
So sometimes things like this fluster me. I guess they're supposed to.
Bingo.
And I wonder sometimes, because abiding nowhere, awakened mind arises, it's like, oh, that sounds like the point. And I wonder sometimes, how do you view, like, you reach that point, do you then, is the rest of the sutra still useful?
Oh, well, what do you think?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't, probably, because it's lasted for a very long time.
Yeah. I guess, let me turn the question around.
Sure.
When you reach that point, what do you mean when you reach that point?
So for me, it feels like a point to, I mean, now I'm going to start using, like, words about how thinking in my head works. But that seems like a resting point for me, a point where you would, you know, there's a lot of confusion in the sutra, there's a lot of beauty in the sutra, but I would hit that line and say, oh, this feels like what this is about, and be tempted to discard the rest of it.
Well, in a way, it could be seen that way, except that how do you really rest where there's abiding nowhere?
Yeah, you fall.
Yeah, so I haven't had any great enlightenment experience myself where I've felt that as deeply as possible, but my sense is that part of abiding nowhere really means not even this statement. But out of nowhere, awakened mind arises. It arises. That implies to me it might fall. I think we have to keep working. That's my thought. I think Zach was slightly quicker than you.
So the other day, Becky and I went to a restaurant that we've gone to before, but not for a while. And all the workers looked like prisoners. Like the owner hired people who were, like in prison to work there. And at first it was kind of off-putting. And then Becky said that she read that the owner does a lot of community work, and okay, it all kind of made sense. And then I thought, let's come back here. It's cool that all these sort of rough-looking guys are dishing out the food and all. And then I thought, oh, that's me thinking, cool, let's go back there. I didn't arise out of nowhere. Was that what it was?
No, abiding nowhere.
Abiding nowhere. I mean, I was calculating. And so I guess my question is, and I know this is impossible to answer, but how do you have good intentions, maybe even kind of bodhisattva intentions, but it's me thinking about having those intentions? How do you get past the me part?
Through it. So you notice that your me has arisen, and then you sit with that me. You sit with, is there discomfort? Does it feel good? Does it feel just all the things about the me? You can also look into the things you've learned. This isn't an anti-mind school. You can start looking up, is it a good idea to hire formerly incarcerated citizens? In my opinion, it's a great idea. I've read a lot about it, and my opinions really have evolved about this over time. But as you learn more, keep looking at the me that arises. You know, oh, I'm learning so much more. I was a bad person before for not knowing this, and I'm a good person now. You know, that arose in me. So yeah, just keep going through the me. Okay,
what's next? Thank you, Steve. I was just wondering if you think that it's possible to really fully attain that kind of awareness while we still have a body. You know, I mean, it seems to me that these are instructions about how to practice. And the language is confounding. I mean, or the things they talk about are confounding, maybe designed that way to jog us out of the way we generally perceive things. But I guess the Buddha's students, I mean, the people who awakened, I guess that answers my question, but I'm not so sure. What does it mean to be awakened?
For me, one of the differences over the years, as I have been exposed to more of the Prajnaparamita literature, such as the Diamond Sutra, and of course, the first one was the Heart Sutra that I was exposed to probably the first time I ever went to a service at a Zen center, is that it starts off being here like what the, and then it sort of infiltrates, and like if I had done what I do now the first time I ever sat, I probably wouldn't have come back, because now sometimes I'll sit down and I'll find myself in a state of mind where It's as if I'm saying, no, 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 not that, no, not that. I'm kind of telling myself gently to let go. But if somebody had given me that instruction, sit there and just say no to everything that comes up, I would not have stayed. And if I had tried it, I probably would have been very unhappy. So to me, there are stories of sudden awakening. I think that, for what it's worth, maybe there are sudden awakenings, but I'm guessing that all of the sudden awakenings come after years and years and years of work, years of zazen, years of taking it off the cushion with us into the world. And then gradually, if you notice that you can practice with harder practices and it doesn't hurt you and it encourages you, you've awakened since before. If you lost your mind, you'd be dead. So that's the last thing I'll say about that.
Yeah, I know. But I was just thinking, I don't really know how to say it, how to be empty while you still have a form, you know, is the practice, I guess, is how I see it. Thank you for the lecture.
I don't know the formulation. I'm not sure if he changed, but I'm really familiar with, you know, what do you say, Subhuti? Have I taught X?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, or no, you have taught no X, therefore, it just now, A, not A, A, because over and over and over, it's in that, I mean, I just think that's part of it, is that we're hard at it, and so summing it up isn't very nice. But I need to be slapped. So I just think that reading that formulation over and over and over and over and over, no, it's no, like you just said.
I'll give it a minute in case anyone's contemplating. Okay, thank you.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.